For the rest of the hour, you look at energy and where our future energy supply might come from. Now, if you ask the average American about coal, I think they're likely to think that it went the way of the Model T. You don't see many coal trucks dumping the black rocks into people's basements anymore, but nearly 50% of our electricity still comes from coal. Power up your computer, take a hot shower, and the chances are pretty good that the coal coal is being burned in a power plant somewhere to provide the energy. And last year, about 1 billion tons of coal were burned in the United States. Sounds like a lot, but America has a lot of coal. Advocates of coal energy say there is enough here within the American borders to supply our energy needs for the next 250 years. The U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of coal. It's been talked about like that many times. But what about the sulfur dioxide, the mercury, the other pollutants we're generating along with the energy, even the carbon dioxide? Critics ask, what about those? Aren't they detrimental to making coal as part of our energy future? Advocates say that soon the technology will be possible, make it possible for power plants to have zero emissions. They won't be giving off anything. No need to worry about carbon dioxide. We'll just bury it underground, say those in favor of burning more coal. Well, critics reply that getting the coal, getting it just out of the ground, it's an increasingly risky and environmentally unsound method. And storing this carbon dioxide, well, it's just not going to work. We haven't proven it, and it might not really get to past the drawing board stage. What do you think? We'll talk about these and other issues as we debate, is coal a good way to use our energy independence? And if you'd like to talk about with us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Jeff Goodale is the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. He's a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. He joins us from NPR affiliate WAMC in Albany. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Goodell.
Nice to be here, Ira.
You're welcome. Joe Lucas is the executive director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, a nonprofit group that sponsors those clean coal ads you've probably been seeing on TV and on the web. He joins us from our NPR station WLRN in Miami. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's talk about coal. Give us the case first for coal, if you might. Tell us why coal is Joe is the best thing. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal, are we not?
Well, actually, we're not, Ira. We are the OPEC of coal. We have more energy in the form of coal here in the United States than the Middle East has in its entirety in oil. And so we do have this available resource right here at home. It's an affordable energy resource. It's about half the cost of using other fuels. It's a fuel that we've used primarily to generate electricity here in this country. As you indicated, over half of our electricity comes from coal. It is an energy resource that could be looked at to do some additional things, near-term conversion of coal to clean diesel and other transportation fuels, ultimately coal fueling the hydrogen economy. But what really makes coal a winner for us going forward, and it's not the winner. As a matter of fact, we're going to need all of our energy resources going forward, not just coal. We're going to need everything because our energy demand is continuing to grow in this country. But what really makes coal an option for the future is because of the fact of technology is helping us to address the environmental concerns about using coal.
Let me just stop you there because we have to go to a break and I want to give you a chance to complete that whole thought before I have to cut you off. Okay, Joe, so hang on. We'll get back with Joe Lucas and Jeff Goodale talking about coal, making the case for coal, and then the anti-coal debate with Jeff Goodale. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking for the rest of the hour about coal, part of our continuing series on alternative energies for the future, with Jeff Goodale, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and with Joe Lucas. And Joe Lucas was telling us first about how much coal there was and tell us about how clean, I think you were headed toward how clean coal could be made. Is that correct?
Exactly, Jeff. And Ira, as you look at what we've done over the past 30 years, I like to draw the analogy to a car. I first got my license back in the mid-70s, and when I lifted the hood of the car, I could probably find the dipstick to change to check the oil. I could even change the oil on my car. But today, when I go out and lift the hood of my automobile, there's so much pollution control, so many pollution control devices, fuel efficiency control devices, computers underneath the hood of the car. I can't even find the dipstick to check the oil, nevertheless change it. The same evolution of technology has happened with power plants. Today, on average, we produce 3 times more energy from coal in this country than we did 30 years ago, 35 years ago, and we have one-third of the emissions of the regulated emissions. Sulfur dioxide, you mentioned earlier, nitrogen oxide, those emissions have been cut by about 70% overall as we look at the fleet. Where are we going a generation from now in the future? I think all of us will come to accept the fact that 35 years from now, the cars we'll be driving will be dramatically different from the cars that are on the road today. And so will the power plants. As a matter of fact, those power plants will have zero emissions. They will not emit any of the pollution that we're looking at today, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, even mercury. Also, because we're concerned about global climate change and reducing the carbon intensity of the energy sector, both here in the United States and around the world, that will be possible as we capture CO2 for permanent storage in underground aquifers. And these power plants will also produce hydrogen as a byproduct, and that hydrogen can be used to fuel automobiles. So I'm very optimistic about the future of coal and where technology allows us to go with that.
Jeff, it looks like something I would see at the World's Fair, you know, the power plant of the future, free of any pollution, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. What's wrong with this scenario, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, the coal industry is very good at touting new technology and less good at actually doing anything about it or building them. The fact is that the kind of coal plants that are being built today are essentially the same technology that's been used for 30 or 40 years. There is new technology that's available now called IGCC, integrated gasification, a kind of gasification of coal. But the industry has resisted building these plants. They prefer to tout these plants that are 10 or 20 years down the road and continue building the same old thing. The fact is that coal can only be considered clean by the narrowest of definitions. It's true that the levels of air pollution of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides that Joe mentioned have fallen. But one of the things he doesn't mention is that the coal industry fought tooth and nail against all of those laws that required those reductions during the 70s and 80s and 90s, spent millions of dollars lobbying against them. And this idea of clean coal doesn't take into account the myriad of other environmental and economic devastation that the coal industry causes. I was just in West Virginia 2 weeks ago, and you know, anyone who's been down there and seen the mountaintop removal mines that are just flattening the southern part of the state and Kentucky would never think that coal is cheap. And the most important thing is carbon dioxide. The fact is that carbon dioxide from coal plants have gone up about 27% since 1990, and they're continuing to go up. And global warming is, as everyone I'm sure on the show knows, is increasing. It's a very urgent problem. We need to cut emissions, most scientists agree, by 50% or more by the year 2050, and the coal industry is going in exactly the opposite direction. So I think that the only way that you can think about coal as clean is in just a very narrow way of thinking about it.
What about the research that we've heard about, you know, putting the CO2 as Joe was talking about, back in underwater or back in aquifers or underground sequestration?
It will certainly work, and it's working now, and they're doing it in many places in the oil industry they pump CO2 down underground into oil fields to help push the oil out. And that works very well. And there's no question that we can build coal plants that can sequester CO2 underground. The question is, first of all, how soon we will do it. The second question is, its capacity is quite limited. It works in certain places, in certain geologic areas, where the structure of the geology underground is just right. It doesn't work, for example, it worked great in Montana or Wyoming, but it's not going to work at all in the Southeast. And the other thing is that we haven't even begun as a culture, as a society, to think about, you know, do we want to embark on this huge campaign to bury millions and millions of tons of CO2 underground all over America? I mean, the biggest sequestration field right now is in Canada. And it will, after 25 years of use, will sequester about 25 million tons of CO2, which sounds like a lot. But I visited a coal plant in Georgia while I was reporting this book that emits that much in 1 year. So, you know, do we want to be living above these giant bubbles of CO2? And CO2 is, some environmentalists have compared CO2 to nuclear waste, and that's not fair at all. But it is, there are a lot of dangers associated with it. CO2 is an asphyxiant. A natural bubble of CO2 was released from a lake in Africa in 1987 and asphyxiated 1,700 people. Do we want to be living above this? We haven't even begun to think about it yet.
Well, I disagree that we haven't begun to think about it. We're in the process of a major undertaking where in cooperation with the federal government, several states, there are these sequestration partnerships that are being funded by Congress, being enacted through the Department of Energy, where lots of communities, lots of stakeholders are out right now studying the various applications of where you can store this, what it will mean to do this long term. I think we are very much addressing what the possibilities are for this for the future as we go forward. I think it is is clearly something that a lot of progress is being made right now on this very issue.
Joe, do any new technologies have to be to create this future pollution-free coal-fired plant? Do any new technologies have to be developed, or we basically have them already?
Well, we basically have them. I'm going to go back and address something else Jeff said about integrated combined cycle gasification. That IGCC technology is the sort of backbone of the infrastructure we're talking about here. And it is very unfair to say that the industry has been slow on the uptake in supporting that technology. I was a special assistant to the Secretary of Energy in the first term of the Clinton administration. And through the DOE Clean Coal Technology Demonstration Project, three IGCCs were built, one of them in Indiana, another one here in Florida, up in Tampa, Florida. That was the last one that came online. It came online in about 1996. A third IGCC was built out in Reno, Nevada. And what happened with that plant is what they found in that demonstration project that there was an inherent problem with the design of that technology, that at that point in time, the technology would not work in elevations above 300 feet sea level. That, tempered with the fact that at that point in time, through deregulation, there were not a lot of coal plants built here in the United States for about a 10-year period, that is sort of the reason why more IGCCs were not built between, say, the early 90s and today. If you look,
Joe,
at
I want to move on to another question because we're running out of time and we have a lot of things to cover. If you say that we have the technologies basically available today, why don't we have the clean plants tomorrow? Why do we have to wait 25, 35 years for these?
And right now we're talking about 10 years before the demonstration of future gen. The issue is that basically you're talking about taking technology, scaling it up to the size that it needs to be used in, and you're making a bunch of technologies that have not worked together have to work together for the first time. You're taking some of the advanced scrubbers, some of the advanced selective catalytic converters, all the technology that's used in a supercritical pulverized coal plant and putting it on and making it work in an integrated fashion with an IGCC. And it is the fact that this is first of its type technology, first of its scale technology, of why it is going to take a while to have that happen. The other thing is, and I don't think people realize this, just the siting of a power plant
takes sometimes 5 to 6 years. And so from that standpoint, once the site is selected for FutureGen, which is the partnership between the federal government and industry to work together to build the first of its type pollution-free power plant, once that site selection takes place, it will take several years to get all the permitting authorities that are necessary to move forward with that plant and then begin construction of that plant. That's part of the lead time that we're talking about here.
So you're saying,
can I say something about
yes,
this
Jeff,
quickly?
Please, go ahead.
I want to say I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I am a big believer in technology as a tool to solve social problems, and I really I watched what happened out there, and I know I'm a big believer in these in the idea of we can solve this with new tools, but the fact is that the coal industry, this kind of rhetoric is exactly what happens whenever there is any issue. It was the same talk in the 70s. We can't clean it up. It's too hard. It's too expensive. The stuff's not ready yet. And then they pass laws and it becomes ready, and they do it, and they do it far cheaper than before. It was the same debate with mercury. We can't do it. It's too hard. Stuff's not ready. You know, if we passed a law, they would do it. It was the same thing with IGCC. It's a widely deployed – gasification is widely deployed around the world. There have been a number of IGCC plants that are up and running all around the world. 2 years ago, Power Magazine, the sort of Vanity Fair of the power industry, cover story said coal gasification ready for prime time. I mean, this is just a strategy well known in the industry called delay and fail. They just want to keep doing the same thing.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Anthony in Milford, Pennsylvania. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, folks. I live in a coal mining state, Pennsylvania, and I've been out west, so I've seen the strip mines out there. I've seen the strip mines in Appalachia. And my question is, how can we seriously be talking about expanding an extraction industry? How can we be seriously talking about more combustion, burying carbon, when we are all living on a ball of molten iron that's 6,000 miles in diameter, that's free, that's hotter than the surface of the sun, that's bubbling out of the ground at 4,000 degrees? How can we not be using geothermal? Why are we talking about coal? How stupid are we? Hello?
Now we'll find that out in a minute after I give my ID. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking about coal and now geothermal with Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, Joe Lucas, the executive director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. Joe, do you want to tackle how stupid can we be first, or should I let Jeff do that?
Well, what I would say is, again, I want to go back and say, look at the name of our organization, Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. We are certainly pro-coal, but we're not opposed to other options, too. I mean, geothermal certainly has a role to play. But when you look at the fact that we have 50% of our electricity coming from coal today, sort of turning that ship on a dime and saying, oh, let's just abandon this and go someplace else. I mean, given the resource availability that we have here in this country, having America turn its back on coal would be a lot like having OPEC turn its back on oil.
Jeff?
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone's talking about having America turn its back on coal. I think the reason that energy sources like geothermal, solar, wind, all these other things have so much trouble getting going is because the coal industry, the fact is that a coal plant is a gold mine. These plants are burning coal very cheaply, and they're making a lot of money because they're able to sell into a market where the price is set by gas plants, and gas has been going up. The price of gas has been going up radically. And the essential problem with coal is not a problem with coal per se. The problem is with cheap coal. The problem is that they offload all of the costs that come with coal, such as the destruction of Appalachia, the cooking of the climate, all of these things onto the rest of us. And they just pay for the low cost per megawatt. If coal were truly valued, truly priced, given the damages that it costs, these other sources of energy would be more competitive.
Ira, let me sort of address cost. First off, let me say that I thought Jeff, as I've read some of his background, I thought even though Jeff grew up in the Silicon Valley, I took it that he was a native of West Virginia. And so I thought we had something in common here because I do come from a coal-producing region. I come from Kentucky. Anthony just called in. He was from Pennsylvania. So I do come from a coal-producing region, and I do know what is involved in the extraction of coal.
So you're saying Jeff can't know that because he hasn't lived there?
Well, I thought he was from West Virginia.
Go about the moon. If you don't beat on the moon, you don't know what's going on the moon
I thought he was from West Virginia. But the one thing that really does sort of get to me is whenever you get into this debate, people just sort of talk about, well, let's just pay more for this and it will take care of itself. The problem is, there is a big issue in this country that comes involved with energy prices. For people like me, you, probably many people listening to this show who make over $50,000 a year, we spend only about 4% of our income to cover energy-related expenditures. But as you come down the income spectrum, that story gets very different. For people making between $25,000 and $50,000 a year, they're spending close to 30% of their income to cover energy-related expenditures. And for folks under $10,000 a year, almost half of what they earn goes out the door to cover energy-related expenditures. So when you talk about, well, if we just raised the prices, we could do this, we could do that, that sort of fails to recognize the fact that energy prices in this country are regressive and higher energy costs affect those on low and fixed incomes the hardest.
We're going to have to take a short break, come back and talk more with Joe Lucas, Executive Director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and more of your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about coal as an energy alternative with my guest, Joe Lucas, Executive Director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices, Jeff Goodell, author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secrets Behind America's Energy Future, also contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask you, Joe, have you got a spot and a place for one of these new totally clean power plants for us to look at?
There's about seven states who are competing right now to host the Future Gen project.
Why can't they just build one themselves?
Well, this is quite a contest. This is the equivalent of being able to host the Olympics, if you would, for the state that gets the chance to do this.
Well, my question is this: if you have all the technology and you know how to do it, and you're going to build a power plant, why don't you just go ahead and build a clean one?
Again, we are building clean plants today. One of the reasons why folks are continuing to build new pulverized coal plants is the environmental efficiency of those plants is just as clean as the existing integrated combined cycle gasification plants. This new process of building the Future Gen project is a cost-shared project between the government and the industry. And it is being all the timeline.
Why do we need the government stepping into private industry here? Why shouldn't they build their own power plants and make them energy efficient? If they're everything you say they're going to be, why shouldn't they just build one? Why do I need my tax dollars to pay for that?
Let me ask you this. I'm going to assume if you're in D.C., who do you get your electricity from?
I'm not in D.C. We're in New York.
Oh, you're in New York. Mm-hmm. So your local utility. Let's say that your local utility decides to go out and build Future Gen, which is going to be about a $100 billion project. Let's just say, since this is a first-of-its-kind project, first-of-its-kind technology, first-of-its-scale technology, let's just say they build it and it doesn't work. Do you think the utility is going to take that $100 billion loss itself?
No, well, it doesn't. But you wouldn't build it if you didn't think it was going to work.
Well, but again, you don't think it's not going to work, but there is always the chance with new technology that you're doing something, that some unexpected thing happens. So if you do that, and for some reason the demonstration does not prove successful, should the people who pay bills to that utility, should that cost be passed along to them?
That's why not then just build a nuclear power plant for the same price, and we know they work?
Well, I think that we will be building nuclear power plants also. That's the whole thing. Some folks want to say that it has to be this or that. We think that there has to be a mix of fuel options going forward, because any time you put too many eggs in one basket, that's when you have a problem.
Jeff?
Well, I think you put your finger on the problem here is that the coal industry wants to say that this is a technological problem. You know, it's always, oh, if we can just do a little more research, if we can just get a few more grants, if you can just give us a few more $100 million, we'll figure this out. And it's the same story over and over. It is not a technological problem. It is a political problem. It is a political problem because it is not a level playing field. The coal industry is one of, if not the most politically powerful industries in the United States. As it's been well documented during the Bush administration, numbers of rollbacks on all kinds of things, from mine safety to regulations on dirty coal plants, all kinds of things. It is this idea that there's a sort of open and competitive marketplace is just frankly hilarious. I mean, there's not anything close to an open and level playing field when it comes to electricity power. The coal industry over the years has managed to offload all of the costs that come with burning coal onto us as a society in terms of health care, asthma, global warming, destruction of the states of Appalachia, and pay none of it themselves. If it were a level playing field and there was open competition, that would be great. But it's not. It's a rigged game.
I very much disagree. I mean, there were so many false statements there. I'll just try and handle two of them. Number one, if the coal industry is so politically powerful and there's been these rollbacks of environmental protection in the Bush administration, why just last year did the EPA publish rules that will force the coal industry here in America to reduce emissions 70% beyond existing Clean Air Act standards? Secondly, if asthma and coal emissions are linked somehow or another, why have we seen a dramatic increase in asthma cases over the past 30 years, while at the same time emissions have come down? I mean, these things make really good snippets and sound bites, but they don't comport with the reality.
Jeff?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that it's pretty self-evident. Anyone who goes to West Virginia to see what coal mining has done there, anyone with the American Lung Association, well-respected, in their 2005 State of the Air report, 24,000 people in America die premature deaths from air pollution from coal plants. I mean, this is not a... the science on all of this, on air pollution, health effects of air pollution, on the devastation of mining, on on global warming, the urgency of global warming, these are not even close to debatable. I mean, the question is really now on global warming and all of this stuff is, what are we going to do about this, and how are we going to address this stuff in a coherent way?
What about those EPA standards that he was mentioning in the first point?
About cleaning up
the
sulfur dioxide pollution. Well, yes, that's great. I mean, they've done that, but that's something that's been in the works for a long time, and it's been delayed. It's a kind of replacement for the rollback of what was called New Source Review regulations on dirty coal plants. And there's been progress. There's absolutely been progress, but. But to hold up that one thing as evidence of making all of these other arguments and all these other effects to say that they're not accurate is just not true.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a caller or two. Jay in Overland Park, Kansas. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I've been a long admirer of you and your show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
A number of years ago, I was an electrician working on a power plant, and I'd like to hear the speakers discuss enforcement of the regulations, because in my day, I saw the power plant turn off the scrubbers and precipitators on a regular basis when night fell. And I'll take my call off the air.
Okay, Joe, does that happen?
Well, I mean, I would have to say that basically you're asking me to deal with a hypothetical situation here. I mean, each power plant has an operating agreement.
I ask you for a fact. I mean, he said he saw them. Do you know of any cases where that happens?
They may not be required to run those controls at night. It may only the operating agreement or the permit limits for the plant may only require them to run them during the day or under certain circumstances. I mean, you can't deal with a generic sense here because they would not be required to run them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week that they're in operation necessarily.
Mm-hmm. It is hard. It is hard to make a blanket statement about everybody from one case. Right. What about, Jeff, an interesting part of your book, you touched a bit about the power of the coal industry and certainly in this administration. And you talk about how President Bush came into office promising to put caps and reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And then what happened?
Then the coal lobbyists and Haley Barbour, some of the big coal operators and utilities like the Southern Company and Peabody Energy, who are very politically connected, got to him. And he quickly reversed his campaign pledge to begin to put mandatory limits on carbon dioxide emissions. And just let me say that this is really the big scary thing for the coal industry because, once we begin and everyone agrees that, in America now, I think that the momentum, I'm actually reporting a story about this right now, mandatory carbon dioxide limits are going to happen. And what's really happening in this, and that's going to change the price of electricity from coal plants and make them much less competitive because coal is by far the most carbon dioxide intensive fossil fuel. So what is going to happen in the future is, in a couple of years, we're going to have these regulations that come down. And what's really going on with this coal boom now and why so many of these plants are rushing to be built is to get them permitted and at least going before these regulations happen so they can be grandfathered in and produce cheap power and big profits for these companies for years to come.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also that that Christy Todd Whitman, the EPA administrator under the first administration, who eventually resigned, that she said she resigned over personal reasons. But you think in the book she resigned because she was sort of stabbed in the back over the CO2 emissions.
Well, she was, when she was the governor of New Jersey, she was very progressive about this, about greenhouse gas emissions. She had in the weeks before Bush's reversal, had been going around Europe talking about how progressive George Bush was and how, yes, we're going to begin to deal with this and we're going to begin to deal with it in an intelligent way, in an irrational way. And she really put herself out on a limb and then was sort of just summoned into the Oval Office and told suddenly, sorry, Christy, we're not doing that. And it was a major embarrassment for her. And, Colin Powell would in cabinet meetings, would joke about her being the administration's wind dummy, kind of thrown out the door to see how the winds were blowing. And, she had, whether she should have resigned then or not, a lot of people debate. But, she stuck around for another couple of years and then kind of made a graceful exit.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Go to Bob in Oklahoma.
Hey, Bob. Yeah, your guest got it right there. Peabody Coal, they get to you. Check out what the Navajo people out in New Mexico are going through and out west where they're trying to mine uranium. And take a good hard look, as a previous caller mentioned, at the damage that's done in the Appalachia country from coal mining. And I would just like to suggest a book that people read called The Emperor Wears No Clothes that suggests that hemp can be used as an alternative fuel source right now. It's the political situation that's holding up the energy situation in this country.
Mm-hmm. We get at least one call a week when we do an energy on hemp, which used to be a huge cash crop before World War II.
There's very little discussion on hemp on the airwaves.
Yeah. Well, we talk about it. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the coal this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Jeff,
let me just say this for 1 second, going back to Jeff's assertion.
Go, Joe. Go ahead.
If Jeff is right that we are going to have mandatory carbon restrictions here in this country, that's truly unfortunate because we know two things about mandatory carbon emission standards. They're hugely expensive and they're ineffective. They're hugely inexpensive in that it will cost the United States economy hundreds of billions of dollars. And you don't have to take my word.
How do you know that?
I'm going to back that up.
Okay. Give me some – finally get some facts into this. We do a science program. We like some facts here. Yes.
If you go back to analysis done by the Energy Information Administration in the Clinton administration, an administration that was hugely in favor of the Kyoto Protocol. They modeled the Kyoto Protocol and found that it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars in a direct hit to the United States economy, the loss of jobs for the United States to enact emission control standards similar to Kyoto. That's
okay,
a fact.
I'm not going to debate that with you. Let me ask you this question. On the other hand, we had a hurricane that went through New Orleans. We estimated it cost $100 billion in damage. What happens when all the oceans rise and New York, New Orleans, Florida, Alaska, the rest of the Gulf Coast, how much damage is that going to cause compared to the $100 billion that you're talking about?
Well, let's get to
can
why,
you get your let me, could let, you get your mind gonna, around a number for me on that?
Let me go to why it's ineffective and why what you want to do is
I don't want to do it. I'm just questioning your numbers
and why it's ineffective. Because as you look going forward, the growth in greenhouse gas emissions is not going to happen here in the United States. It's going to happen in countries like China, India, and other places in the developing world. These are places which have huge indigenous reserves of coal, must bring the power of electricity to their economy and to their people, and they're going to use that coal either with advanced technologies or without advanced technologies. And that's why I'm saying if you want to address the issue of climate change, you're actually bailing out a bathtub with a thimble with the water
Excellent
still running
point.
Full blast.
Excellent point,
if
Jeff.
You try
how do we,
and
how do we get
emissions.
The other people to own up to this coal problem also, Jeff? He's saying it's an enormous problem in this country. It's going to be worse for the other countries.
Right. Let me say two things about that. First of all, I have 8-year-old twins, and when one of them drops, makes a big mess in their bedroom, we have a simple rule. You make the mess, you clean it up. So in a certain way, that's what's going on in the atmosphere here. The reason that the global warming, the carbon dioxide levels are so high is because of the industrialized West. So we, first of all, have a moral obligation just for having made this mess and caused this problem to deal with it. Second of all, one of the best ways to help China, and I've been to China a number of times, to help China move away from coal is for ourselves. We are the entrepreneurial power of the world. We are the innovators. We're the people who can solve this problem. And if we adopt new technologies, clean energy technologies, they will adopt them in China also. The quickest way to drive improved technology there is for us to do it here. And you know what? People are figuring this out. I mean, there was $1.4 billion spent on venture capital into clean technology. We have people like Sergey Brin at Google and venture capitalists like John Doerr, who says that what the kind of opportunities, economic opportunities in clean technology, clean energy, figuring out new ways to generate power, are going to make the kind of prosperity in Silicon Valley in the 90s look like a bake sale.
All right, I have to let it go. We can read about the rest of it in your book, Big Coal: The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, with Jeff Goodell. Thank you for joining us, Joe Lucas, Executive Director of Americans for Balanced Energy Choices. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Neil Rausch and Manoli Weatherall in New York, and Linda Mack in Washington. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today, as always, from the trusty team of Key Molesky and Alphonse Finn. Please surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, free teaching material. Our podcast button that you click on if you want a podcast, or a blog on there is also available to you.
Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. We'll be next week in Syracuse, so join us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.